All right, I will call to order this remote meeting of the House Commerce Committee and ask Mr. Brown to take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Present.
Vice Chair Cotiza-Watoon.
Present.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Present.
Representative Barr.
Here.
Representative Carlson.
Carlson present.
Representative Daphne.
Daphne present.
Thank you. Representative Elkins.
Elkins present.
Representative Haley.
Haley present.
Representative Cagle.
Present.
Representative Lee.
Lee present.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly present.
Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard present.
Representative Lucero.
Yes, sir.
Representative Olson.
Present.
Representative Farr.
Present.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen present.
Representative Richardson.
Present.
Representative Tice.
Tice present.
We have a quorum. The first item on our agenda is approval of the minutes from our last meeting. Representative Cotiza-Watoon, have you had a chance to review those minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would move the minutes.
Any discussion to the Cotiza-Watoon motion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for March 3rd, 2021 are approved. The first bill on our agenda is House File 1200 by our very own Ruth Richardson. Representative Richardson, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Chair. I would like to move to re-refer the bill to Human Services, Finance, and Policy.
Representative Richardson moves House File 1200 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Human Services, Finance, and Policy. Representative Richardson, I understand you have an author's amendment. Should we take care of that now?
Yes, Chair. I can talk briefly to the A1 amendment. The A1 amendment would get the bill in the shape that I would like. It clarifies that the bill applies to school districts and charter schools, and it also lays out the certification requirements for an applicant taking leave, and there are a number of technical renumbering changes.
Great. And so Representative Richardson has moved the A1 amendment. Any discussion to the amendment? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. The motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Richardson, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1200 would create a statewide paid family and medical leave insurance benefit program. The program is modeled after our state's unemployment insurance benefit program and would provide a much needed safety net for families in order to be able to take care of themselves, another family member, or for critical bonding with a new child. At some point, the majority of workers will need to take some time away from work to care for a new child, a family member that is sick, or to recover themselves. Caring for others and receiving care is a key component of being human and living a fulfilling life. Unfortunately, the reality for the majority of Minnesotans, it's not that simple. Only about 13% of the Minnesota workforce has access to paid family leave through an employer, and an estimated 44% have access through an employer-provided temporary disability program. The lack of access demonstrates structural inequality. Those who are currently left out of paid family and medical leave programs are often those who need the access the most and are facing the most economic insecurity. Lower paid employees are disproportionately left out of paid family leave programs. Black, Indigenous, and other workers of color are also less likely to have access. And women are also facing disparities when it comes to access to paid family and medical leave programs. Most Minnesotan workers cannot afford to take time off without pay. The key to this bill is that it would ensure that the vast majority of hardworking Minnesotans would not be faced in the impossible choice of caring for themselves, a loved one, or choosing between a paycheck. A serious illness or injury can devastate a family's economic security quickly, as many Minnesotans are only one, two, or a few paychecks away from financial disaster. In the midst of a global pandemic, it has become even more clear. Illness can strike at any time, and families, just like businesses, need safety nets. The National Partnership for Women and Families has conducted national surveys on paid family leave, and in the most recent survey, 8 in 10 voters and overall 84% of voters support permanent paid family and medical leave programs. Paid leave programs generate benefits for employees, employers, and for the state. Just to name a few, a statewide insurance pool helps to level the playing field between small businesses and larger corporations. There's also retention and gender equity. Women who have access to paid leave are 93% more likely to be in the workforce 9 to 12 months after a child's birth than a woman who doesn't have access to leave. Working families with paid leave are more economically secure and significantly less likely to use public support programs in the year after a child's birth. Minnesotans want to work and they want to take care of their families, and this bill can help make that a reality. We also have the added benefit and ability to take advantage of lessons learned from other states that have implemented similar programs that have proven effective, beneficial, and sustainable, even in the midst of the COVID pandemic. I have a number of author testifiers with me today, including Deb Fitzpatrick.
All right, Ms. Fitzpatrick.
Hello, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm going to share a couple of quick slides just to ground us in the policy, if that's okay. Let's see here. All right, start from the beginning. So I'm here today as the policy director for the Children's Defense Fund, but also in my former capacity at the University of Minnesota, where I was at the Humphrey School and led the research team that conducted Minnesota's legislatively mandated design and implementation study in 2016, and that study was updated in 2019. Just to kind of, again, remind people of kind of just the overarching kind of framework that we're working within this bill is different from a lot of the ways we think about benefit provision. House File 1200 is structured as a contributory social insurance program, and that is really the dominant model for how these kinds of benefits are delivered in 8 U.S. states and most countries. And just to drill down on that a bit, that just means that most employers and workers are contributing to a state fund on a regular basis. The average or median worker earning about $52,000 a year would be contributing about $3, and their employer would be contributing $3 to match each week. And there's just a couple of exceptions. Employers with comparable benefits can provide their own private plan under the bill. And self-employed people are able to choose to join the program if they desire. It's important to acknowledge that this is an earned benefit. Eligibility for the program is based on attachment to the workforce and in prior earnings, plus the need for a leave. That's eligible leave under the program. And then finally, also really important to say that healthcare providers in most cases are certifying the need for the leave, the length of leave, and then workers are making a claim on the state fund for the support that they receive while they're on leave. And as Representative Richardson mentioned, House File 1200 builds on many unemployment insurance definitions and processes, and that's to reduce employer burdens so that they're kind of having the same kind of process that they would be going through under UI. And it also helps us ensure that we can have a successful build out of a program in the state. There are a lot of benefits, a lot of reasons why social insurance is the dominant model, not only across the United States now and the states that have it, but also the world. I think the most important one is this idea that it is a portable benefit. It's not attached to a specific job or a specific employer. And as we already mentioned, workers are getting their income from the state fund during their leave. And this is extra important as we see the way the economy has changed over time. The number of workers that have multiple employers either at the same time or successively. And COVID has also shown us about the dangers of relying on benefits from an employer when the need is there. And then as Representative Richardson mentioned, this creates the broadest possible risk pool, and that really keeps the costs low for everyone. The bill splits those low costs evenly between workers and employers. And it does level the benefits playing field in a number of ways. And one I just wanted to call out that we don't talk about a lot is the fact that some employers do end up with workers that have a greater need for leave. And in the current situation, those employers have to bear those costs on their own This levels the playing field between types of employers and the workers that that they have. And then finally, just to, again, to call out that this is really a durable and popular approach. And in part, that's because everyone is, it's an earned benefit that everyone is contributing to. And then everyone has the opportunity to benefit from when they have the need. So just wanted to talk a little bit about the broad benefit structure in the bill. First of all, it's also important to note that this really is a program that's designed to kind of take over where the average number of sick leave days most workers earn, you know, when they hit that mark. So it's really looking at those kinds of leaves where that are in excess of 7 days. It provides up to, I want to emphasize that, up to 12 weeks per year for a worker's own serious health condition and up to 12 weeks per year for care of a family member. And the data from state programs and the U.S. Department of Labor on leave-taking behaviors really shows us that workers most often don't use the maximum number of weeks allowed. And again, I just want to call people's attention to the earlier slide where I said healthcare providers have to certify the need for leave. Workers aren't allowed to just go and take leave whenever they want. They have to have a condition, and that's certified by the by a healthcare provider. And the vast majority of workers, when we look at programs in these other states, use the program for only one leave, often over multiple years. So just a quick note on sustainability. Representative Richardson mentioned this, but we have been, you know, several legislators here have probably seen this bill before. But we are using cost modeling based on the same sophisticated program developed by the U.S. Department of Labor that's used in other states, including Washington State. It seems like, how could it be for $3 that often is raised? How can we possibly make this a benefit available? That is the strength of social insurance. Only a segment of the population is using the program in any given year, but all are paying into the fund so that when your time comes, it's there. And as Representative Richardson mentioned, state programs have provided valuable additional support during COVID, but they have remained solvent. Washington State is the most recent state to kind of come on board fully right at the beginning of the pandemic. They did have higher claims, but their program remains solvent and the premium levels are going to remain the same going into 2021 and are lower than the premiums in our bill, just for note. Then just a quick note on information technology, because I know this is also an issue that gets.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Ms. Fitzpatrick. I want to check with committee members. I am getting a text that some people are experiencing some technical difficulties. If you are a member experiencing technical difficulties and can hear me, would you please raise your hand or nod or some other react somehow so that I can get a sense? And I'm scrolling through the windows and not seeing any. A couple members are noticing that. I wonder maybe if Ms. Fitzpatrick, do you have many slides left?
Nope, just two.
Okay. Well, maybe I don't know if you can speak without the slides, but I don't know if screen sharing is maybe part of the issue there. Maybe we could just.
Sure, that's fine.
Just a guess.
I can do that. Okay, so is that helpful? Can people hear? Okay, all right. Well, I just wanted to say a little bit about information technology because I know that's an issue that's raised. And we are really having some opportunities in this bill to build on successful existing IT infrastructures. We again included those UI components and processes so that we are able to clone many UI elements, also able to use Washington State and Massachusetts products per the Blue Ribbon Task Force recommendations, really are well positioned to hit the ground running on the IT front for this bill. There have been visits to Washington State by state staff, legislators, including Representative Elkins, who is on this particular committee, have and Minnit have met with the vendors in other states. and otherwise experienced during COVID. So I think those are all position us well to be able to really stand this program up from an IT standpoint. And then wanted to say a little bit about the funding and implementation startup process. An IT would build would start with a general fund appropriation. The premiums collection wouldn't happen until January of 2023. I think that's really important to note as we think about businesses coming out of COVID, state coming out of COVID. So this would be hopefully, fingers crossed, post-COVID. And the general fund would be repaid for those startup costs. And once we are paying benefits out in January of 2024, this would be a self-sustaining program. So I'll just leave it at that and I'll be available to answer any questions that folks have.
Thank you, Ms. Fitzpatrick. And then Representative Richardson, did you want to introduce the other authors, testifiers, or should I, would you like me to do that?
Well, Mr. Chair, you can proceed. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Richardson. The next testifier is Tony Mangskow. Ms. Mangskow.
Hi. Thank you for the opportunity to come and talk to the committee. So, Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Tony K. Mangskow, and I live in Rochester, Minnesota. I'm here today on behalf of AARP to tell you about my family and my experience as a family caregiver. Minnesota's population is aging, and family caregivers are the backbone of our long-term care system. As a family caregiver, I've provided care for my adult son who's had a chronic health condition, my mom who has cancer, my developmentally disabled brother, and my adult daughter who has struggled with mental illness and chemical dependency issues. This includes driving them to appointments and including more complex tasks like wound care. I'm doing all of this while working full-time. It's challenging and a full-time job, but my family needs me. Working in cancer research, I hear from other caregivers with similar experiences. Through my years, my role as a family caregiver has been a financial strain. During a 9-month period in 2017, I went without 1/3 of my yearly income due to unpaid time away from work. I've declared bankruptcy in the past. I wasn't able to afford unpaid time away from work, keep a roof over our heads, buy groceries, pay our utilities, and other necessary expenses along the way. In the past 2 months, my mom has been hospitalized twice, spent time in a skilled nursing facility, and most recently was told she needs to switch her cancer therapy. Her cancer has flared again. Today, she starts on a cancer chemotherapy drug, which will need to be administered monthly through an IV in an outpatient setting. She'll need to have family with her, and I'm not sure what the future may bring for my family, but having guaranteed paid time away from work to care for her would ease so much stress on my finances. Unfortunately, my family story is not uncommon, but I'd do anything for my loved ones. The value of a family's emotional support and presence during a loved one's illness cannot be measured, and it should not be degraded or punished by fear of financial difficulty. As caregiving becomes the new normal, most of us will likely be caregivers during our lifetimes. No one should ever have to live with making a choice between not paying their bills and sacrificing their loved one's well-being. It's time for Minnesota lawmakers to pass paid family and medical leave program. An army of family caregivers are counting on you. Thank you for the opportunity to talk with the committee today.
Thank you. The next testifier is Kate Davenport. Ms. Davenport.
Sorry, I had a little bit of technical difficulty. Chair and members, thanks for having me testify today. My name is Kate Davenport. I'm the co-president of Eureka Recycling in Minneapolis, which is a social enterprise with approximately 120 employees. We're also a member of the Main Street Alliance. Like other small businesses, the last year with the pandemic has been challenging. We have operated at full capacity the whole time as we provide a vital service of recycling collection and sorting to communities throughout the state. Of the 120 of us, less than 10 were able to work from home full time. The rest of our team have positions that require them to be on the front line, driving trucks, fixing equipment, and sorting recycling. We were grateful that Congress provided small businesses the ability to provide paid family and medical leave as part of the Families First Act COVID relief adopted last spring. It helped us to meet our responsibility to our employees and to the public health by providing tax credits to businesses that we could continue to pay our employees when they were sick with COVID, had to quarantine or care for family or children. We've always provided paid time off and paid sick time for our staff, and it's been a key benefit to the culture and resiliency of our organization. However, the pandemic revealed that there are times when employees need more paid time off than we can provide. The coverage of COVID-related sick time and paid time off was vital in preventing a widespread infection throughout the staff and keeping us operating over the last year. No one should have to choose between staying healthy and getting their paycheck, especially during a global pandemic. The largest challenges with the program have been that it limits each employee to 80 hours of medical leave and that it's only for COVID-related absences. We decided to cover any time over the 80 hours for COVID-related issues outside of our normal PTO structure to ensure that staff felt supported and stayed home. This was a worthwhile investment of tens of thousands of dollars, but is not something that most businesses could afford to do. This past year showed us that paid family medical leave, as proposed, would actually allow our staff to access these kinds of benefits at a lower cost to us as the business than providing it ourselves. Establishing a paid family and medical leave system through the state is really what will help the small business community. It helps level the playing field for small businesses in attracting and retaining employees, as large employers can often provide the benefit of extended paid leave when small businesses can't. Again, the cost to a small business to pay into paid leave is less than covering this cost ourselves and helps us to retain talent and skills. Let's strengthen these programs and keep them for the long haul. I can't think of a more vital investment right now.
Thank you for your testimony. The next testifier is Julie Noren. Ms. Noren.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to provide testimony today. My name is Julie Noren. I co-own Light Dark Landscape in Minneapolis and am a member of Main Street Alliance. We are a small company that designs and installs landscapes with an emphasis on sustainable solutions and Minnesota native species. My business partner and I work year-round with 4 to 5 seasonal employees joining us during our busy season. Like everyone else, our crew has faced its share of major life events, pregnancies, sick children, long-term injuries that are both typical and singularly important times. Unfortunately, with rare exceptions, we can't afford to cover extended paid leave on a regular basis, especially since one of the times we did, the funds we saved for the leave were heavily taxed because they looked like extra profit that we left sitting in the bank. During the pandemic, the Federal CARES Act offered a temporary solution for us to support our employees and keep our business running. It provided tax credits so we could pay full wages to our employees while they quarantined at home, ensuring the rest of us could reduce exposure to COVID-19 and keep the work moving forward. There's no reason the goals of the CARES Act, to keep business going while allowing for periods of time to focus on health and family, only apply to pandemic times. Small businesses like mine employ nearly half of the U.S. workforce, but we cannot bear the cost of supporting families alone. We need the scale and authority of government to create a paid family and medical leave fund that we and our employees pay into incrementally. Not unlike unemployment insurance, a plan like this would allow us to plan for and provide access to financial support for employees, as well as business owners temporarily called away by health and family demands. A national poll showed that nearly 2/3 of small business owners across the country support a paid leave policy. Among other benefits, it provides peace of mind that small business owners and employees don't have to choose between their health and their livelihoods. To build a more sustainable American future, we need a state-backed, shared responsibility paid family leave program to be part of the new normal. Please support House File 1200, and also thank you for this opportunity to provide testimony.
Thank you. And the last testifier brought by the author is Jessica Peterson-White. Ms. White. Ms. Peterson-White. Do we have Ms. Peterson-White? I don't see her on the Zoom, so I think we will move to public testimony, and if she comes back, we can always go back to her. The first member of the public to testify is Lowen Shorthurst from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce.
For the record, my name is Lauren Shadhorst, and I'm the Director of Workplace Management and Workforce Development at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'm speaking today representing the Chamber's 6,300 businesses and 500,000 employees, and also on behalf of the Chamber Federation, which represents more than 43 local chambers and 21,000 businesses, the Minnesota Manufacturers Coalition, which represents a wide range of individual manufacturing associations across the state, and the United for Jobs Coalition, which represents nearly 80 organizations and their hundreds of thousands of employees in opposition to House File 1200. In light of time constraints, I have submitted my full written remarks as testimony and a one-page document co-signed by the coalition members I just mentioned. With that, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I will begin my testimony. I'm testifying today to reiterate the top message we have shared with the legislature on behalf of the Minnesota business community. Minnesota's economic recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic must be the top priority for this session. We oppose attempts to impose unworkable one-size-fits-all paid leave mandates because of the variety and the nuances in many workplaces across Minnesota. With massive pandemic-driven changes to work rules and conditions, state-driven cost burdens matter all the more. Minnesota employers provide employees with innovative and robust benefits promoting wellness and flexibility while maintaining the ability to operate safely and manage a variety of workplaces across the state. Employers in our state currently must also adhere to a strict set of labor laws and workplace standards at all levels of government in order to maintain safe, healthy, respectful, and inclusive workplaces. Within the current regulatory regime, employers must have the autonomy to make staffing decisions and provide wages, benefits, and schedules that are appropriate for their workplace and responsive to workplace needs. House File 1200 places a new payroll tax on every employer to create a broad new state-run insurance program that will collectively cost the Minnesota business community $2.2 billion over its first 3 years. In addition to the direct cost on employers, the proposal will, conservatively, take years of development and hundreds of state full-time employees to start, implement, and administrate at a time when state agencies are completely overleveraged due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Most importantly, this proposal creates a mechanism for an employee to be away from their job for up to 24 weeks each year. That's 44% of a working year. Furthermore, this bill requires employers to maintain specific records in a specific format or risk significant fines and liabilities for a set of benefits that a majority of our members are already offering their employees in some form. In a time of economic recovery, the Chamber and its partners support a do-no-harm approach that limits additional cost burdens and mandates on employers, particularly small employers, who are doing their best to keep their doors open and Minnesotans employed. For these reasons, we respectfully encourage a no vote on House File 1200 and appreciate the opportunity to share our opposition with the committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Shadhorst. Our next testifier is Jill Larson from the Minnesota Business Partnership. Ms. Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I am Jill Larson with the Minnesota Business Partnership. Our members are the CEOs and leaders of Minnesota's largest employers, most of which are headquartered here in Minnesota. And as you're probably aware, these employers already provide significant benefits to their employees, including various types of paid leave. And so although we appreciate the goal of the proposal, we do have many questions and concerns about its scope, the implementation details, and the cost. No, not enough time to go into all those today, so I'm just going to point out a few of our primary concerns. As was mentioned earlier, it is a new mandate on every employer, public, nonprofits, and private employers to provide at least up to 24 weeks of paid leave to every employee. It's not consistent with the existing Family Medical and Leave Act in terms of eligibility or benefits, and so that is going to cause some huge administrative and cost headaches. It is more expansive and varies significantly from the handful of other states that have a program currently in place. And one of our primary concerns is this issue of allowing an employer who currently provides benefits to continue providing a private plan. Few employers will actually qualify for this so-called opt-out because be able to continue offering their own plan because very few, if any, even if they offer very generous benefits, provide up to 24 weeks exactly the way that the bill is prescribed. And that's what the opt-out calls for. The proposal makes it really difficult and frankly provides a disincentive for employers to provide their own paid leave. So it would need much more flexibility in our opinion to be workable. And the cost was mentioned. It is a new payroll tax on every employer. It will be imposed on local governments, which could result in property tax increases. And for those employers like my members that are already providing a benefit, They're probably going to still have to pay the tax because they're not providing it exactly as prescribed in the bill. And so in effect, they're being told they have to pay twice. And so our preference is that you allow those employers and employees who are happy with the benefits that they get now to continue with those benefits without the added administrative costs and burdens that are in this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. The next testifier is Kim Lewis of the Minnesota School Board Association. Ms. Lewis.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Kim Lewis. I'm with the Minnesota School Boards Association. We represent all 333 school boards across Minnesota. And this afternoon, I'm also speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, our superintendents, the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, which are our metro superintendents, and the Minnesota Association of Business Officials. They are the folks that keep our school districts running and operational as far as the finances go. We appreciate the opportunity to share our thoughts on House File 1200. As with last year's bill, our school district business officials and HR representatives have alerted us to three main concerns or questions regarding this proposal. Our primary concern is the cost to schools. School boards do not have the authority to levy for the funds that would be needed to cover the employee portion of this proposal. We can't tax for it. In addition, when employees are out, districts must hire a sub. That's another direct cost to the outcome of this bill. Since we don't produce a project such as widgets and can't increase our price per se, the funds would need to come out of the general fund, in other words, our students' classrooms. Another question is how collective bargaining would be impacted by this. If passed, would that statewide benefit be a part of local bargaining negotiations? Would it supersede negotiations or both? And how does this align with currently negotiated paid time off in CBAs for similar reasons of leave? Something that's problematic and we ask the author to consider is the July 1st effective date. This date is in the middle of the teachers' collective bargaining agreement, which goes from 2021 to 2023. Finally, due to the nature of the workforce within our school districts, there may be a potential for a much greater need for a number of substitutes. As I mentioned briefly a moment ago, employees could potentially be out of the classroom for 24 weeks of the school year or longer if they were to use their accrued sick and vacation time after that. If this were the case, our HR representatives who struggle now to hire subs wonder how there would be an adequate number of highly qualified substitute teachers and other support professionals, how they could be secured. It's our responsibility to keep continuity in the classroom with a highly qualified individual in front of our students. We plan to continue discussions with both our district personnel and Representative Richardson, and we appreciate the committee's time and listening to our concerns today. Thank you.
And the last member of the public who signed up to testify is Corey Anderson of the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters and National Association of Life Underwriters. Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair and member, I'm Corey Anderson. I am here representing NAFA and NAHU, more than 1,000 advisors in Minnesota. I am the owner and founder of Disability Geek, specializing in disability insurance, and I've been in the business over 20 years. I have 4 employees, and through the years, we have worked with 1,250 plus clients protecting the income of the owners and their employees. Some are hourly and some are salaried with bonus based on their desired work schedule. It's my 20th year serving on the state and local NAFA board in various roles and third year for MAHU working on the legislative related issues. I'm a frequent speaker in the industry at related meetings, events, and conferences. I'm proud to have lived in Minnesota my whole life and currently reside in Albertville with my wife and 4 children. So why am I here? Myself and along with MAHU and NAFA are opposed to this bill. The members of this committee need to ask themselves, what problem is this bill solving? I say that because as a specialist in the area, I can tell you that the private sector has products available with very broad coverage for just about every group and individual. The market is competitive with many providers offering coverage for disability income, so the prices are very affordable. To the extent that witnesses have run into problems, they may need to talk to another agent that has more expertise in these lines of business because the solutions are out there, including for all the people that have already testified about their businesses not being able to get coverage, you can get coverage. What this bill does is put the state government in direct competition with the private sector, both insurance carriers and insurance agents. It's not an underserved market, as I said before. The competition is fierce and the coverage is easy to come by with the companies fighting for market share by offering product innovations and lower prices. Family medical leave, products that help you pay so you can take care of a family member, have a child, or out due to sickness, injury, already exist with well-defined language. Last year, there was testimony about a business not being able to find this coverage. I work in this space regularly. I can tell you that the coverage already exists and the premiums are pretty reasonable. For coverage that provides for my team and my insurance agency for sickness, childbirth, etc., it's already readily available. And the premium my business pays on behalf of the three employees that wanted the coverage, I pay for it out of our business, is $106 a month. I don't think a one-size-fits-all product from a government agency that has no experience offering such a product or with accurately pricing such a product provides a solution. The public is not interested in another unfunded mandate on business and their employees that creates an annual payroll tax exceeding $800 million. This is the highest priority of NAFA and the health underwriters at the national and chapter level because it would raise costs for Main Street small businesses when they are doing their best to start and keep the doors open, many times with the owners not taking a paycheck while they grow the business. The bill will create more barriers to new businesses. This bill is what is wrong for small businesses that employ so many in this great state. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Apparently, I spoke too soon, and we do have one other person who is back. I already mentioned her, Jessica Peterson, right? Ms. Peterson-White.
Thank you so much, and my sincere apologies for my technical difficulties earlier. Thank you for hearing us today. Mr. Chair and members, I'm Jessica Peterson-White. I own Content Bookstore, and I serve on the Northfield City Council, and I'm also a member of Main Street Alliance. When my son Thorsten was born in 2016, I budgeted to have about a month at home, and then I eased back into work. It was too expensive to cover all of my hours at the shop at that point, so I spent a lot of days and nights with a baby and a laptop in my arms or with a little guy napping behind the counter. Lyra was born early last March, and while I'd planned carefully so that I could be home with her for 10 weeks, it didn't work out that way. Because of the pandemic, my maternity leave lasted a little more than a week, and then I was working harder than ever before to make sure my bookstore survived 2020. Self-employment has given me flexibility, but I've made painful trade-offs between investing in my business and caring for my babies. In 2018, the city of Northfield passed a 6-week paid leave policy for our employees. We heard many stories of similarly terrible choices our city employees were facing, and all of these stories represent costs, often in replacing staff, but also in morale, when people are forced to choose between what's best for their families and their jobs. We also heard resoundingly that the available short-term disability insurance was woefully inadequate for many situations. We're proud of our policy at the City of Northfield, but it's not enough, and unpredictability is our biggest constraint. It's hard to budget because our pool is small. It just makes sense to ask employers and employees to contribute to a statewide fund, which would benefit everyone when they need it and protect us all from big variations in costs. Statewide paid leave insurance would also mean that Content and the City of Northfield could compete with larger employers that are right here in our community by offering comparable benefits. And it would ensure that when one of my 12 employees has a new child or an illness, they could care for their families and return ready to work, while my business would have the resources to cover their responsibilities. It would make my business stronger and more resilient. I don't think anybody believes that babies should go to daycare 2 weeks or 6 weeks after they're born, or that it's humane to force a new mom back to work at that point either. But if we're not providing a system that keeps family income steady during those precious early months, we're pretending that that is realistic, or we're pretending that working parents can afford to skip a few paychecks. Every city employee, every Content Bookstore employee has a family counting on them to be both caregivers and breadwinners. Nobody should have to choose between the well-being of their child and their job. Please support a paid family leave system to ensure that all families get a healthy and secure start. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We do have a large number of members who have signed up to speak now and ask questions, so we will go through them. The first member is Representative Rasmussen. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to the bill author, Representative Richardson, for the discussion today. Mr. Chair, my question is for the bill author. You know, Representative Richardson, we've heard a lot about the 24 weeks of paid leave that would be possible under this proposal we're talking about today. And you know, as was mentioned, you know, that's just 2 weeks shy of potentially being on paid leave for half a year. And I was wondering, Representative Richardson, could you list any other states that have a benefit that reaches out to 24 weeks?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Rasmussen, for your question. Our bill follows really similarly the Washington model as well, which reflects many of the same provisions that you see within the bill today. But one thing I would want to really point out is that we already have data on how much leave individuals are taking within a given year for those in Minnesota who already have leave. And only about 13% of folks with leave available to them take it in any given year. And the average amount of leave is 6.6 weeks. And there's also data that is just out of Washington as well, as it's closing in on its first year. And the data looks very similar. And so while the up to 12 weeks for one's own health condition and up to 12 weeks for bonding, that really seems to be within a situation of where you would have someone who would have maybe a serious health condition or and then maybe would have a new child within the same year. That just doesn't seem to be happening very often, but it is something that could occur.
Any follow-up, Representative Rasmussen?
Yeah, a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Richardson. And I don't know if you mentioned if Washington has 24 weeks or more or not, or how they compare, but the concern that I have is, the district that I represent is close to North Dakota, and many of the larger businesses in the community have operations actually in both states. So I worry about how increasing the cost of employing Minnesotans could cause those jobs to leave the state, especially when the proposed benefits like those in this plan are just out of step with what we're seeing from other states and from peer states. So thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to raise those concerns.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have more questions than I know we have time for, so I'll ask maybe three or four or five. The first question, Mr. Chair, and for Representative Richardson, is can you identify in the Minnesota Constitution where you believe that there's authority to even impose this on employers?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lucero, we would not be the first state to have a paid family leave plan, and I'm not aware of any being struck down as being unconstitutional.
I would add that we have a number of similar programs, taxes and other programs under existing law, so I also think that there's probably solid constitutional footing. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just for clarification, I was referring to the Minnesota Constitution, so citing other states would be absolutely irrelevant to my question, but I'll move on to the next one. I know that there was kind of an IT fluctuation happening there when one of the testifiers was going on about the IT part. So, Mr. Chair and Representative Richardson, can you please quickly clarify, is the IT infrastructure for this new system, is it going to be an entirely new system, or is it utilizing existing infrastructure?
And very briefly, because it is the case that the IT infrastructure is more or better within the jurisdiction of a different committee. But Representative Richardson, if you wanted to briefly answer that question.
Okay, well then, Mr. Chair, actually, I'll just do this. Is there a fiscal note? I'll just go on to the next question on this, really. What's the cost anticipated for the IT infrastructure?
And again, that would be, we don't have fiscal cost over fiscal jurisdiction over the IT. So, I mean, I don't mind having Representative Richardson. I just don't want to get too far down this road, Representative Lucero. So Representative Richardson, if you have an answer to either of those questions, I don't mind answering, but I'd ask Representative Lucero to try and keep us in commerce.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the infrastructure would be built on the existing unemployment insurance infrastructure. That is also the way that Washington also built out its plan as well. And we have seen that even in the midst of the pandemic, that the department was able to respond very quickly with the pandemic unemployment insurance to get things up and running for Minnesotans to be able to take advantage of that. So it's a system that the state has extensive experience with, and we are currently waiting on a fiscal note for the bill.
And as I mentioned a minute ago, this is not a committee that has any fiscal, we're seeing this on a policy basis. The fiscal matters are handled by committees with fiscal jurisdiction over the bill. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yeah, so just a quick comment on the IT system is that we do have an extensive experience here in the state of Minnesota with government trying to develop IT systems. We have Minsure, Royal Flop. We know how much painful pain that exhibited on Minnesotans with having to dial in over phone and pen and paper or pencil and paper. And then with Minlars, over $100 million completely burned of taxpayer money. Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, would your proposal cover those that are less than 18 years old, or is it just people that are 18 and above?
Representative Richardson.
Representative Lucero, in order to be eligible for the program, an individual would have to meet the eligibility requirements that are set forth, and it's based upon the amount of wages that would have been collected within some previous quarters.
And Representative Lucero, you promised me three or four questions, and by my count, this is number four, so I'll give it back to you.
Yep. So again, my question is, who's in scope? Is a person who is a minor eligible, so a 14, 15, 16, 17-year-old, or is it just those that are 18 and above?
Representative Richardson?
Mr. Chair, so eligibility is dealt with in Article 1, Section 8, and it talks about meeting a threshold of 5.3% of the state's annual wage. So for those, and that would be roughly about $3,000. I mean, that would fluctuate based upon the annual wage in terms of who would be eligible. There are also some exemptions that are written into the bill as well around independent contractors. And so that's where eligibility is dealt with within the bill.
And Representative Lucero, I'll give you a chance. If you want to close out here with any comments, I'll give you the opportunity.
I appreciate it, Mr. Chair. I'm just still on the same question. I'm trying to determine. I don't know what the eligibility for the income is. If I was 14 years old when I got my first two jobs, pushing carts at Rainbow Foods and Burger King. I was 14 years old working two part-time jobs. Would I qualify if I was sick under this system? As a 14-year-old, could I make a claim? Because I was making well over $12,000 combined between those two employers at that age.
Okay. I think, are you putting that as a question or as a comment, Representative Lucero?
I'm trying to figure out if somebody less than 18 years old would qualify for this system.
I will put that last question, Representative Richardson, then we'll move on. Representative Richardson.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair, for the question. Again, in terms of eligibility and the way that it's written within the actual program, it is based upon income earned.
Okay. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am just really, it's a good idea. I understand it totally as a mom. I worked until my second was born, and then I stayed home with them because I felt that was the best deal for them. But what I will say is that from that point on, my husband and I were on our own. No matter what we were doing, whether it was starting our own companies and doing other things, and we just saved for it. We just made it happen, and I get it. I get it. Things are different right now, but I also get they're different, too, for the employer. And I'm looking at this through the lens of the folks that I am hearing the most from at this time, and they are like, how do I stay in business? I'm one chef short of closing my business. They can't find employees to stay open. They're not sure they're going to be open when the governor finally decides that he's done and he's going to open things up. I'm not really sure we're going to have a whole lot here. We have a hard time finding employees. People are not working, and yet we're talking about more benefits. So I guess my question is, for those employees who aren't working, but yet they're still employed, how does this fit in with them? How are our business owners going to possibly wrap their head around the fact that they have to do this right away? How are they going to find those costs?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the questions. I would say a couple of things. One, in terms of the timing of this, This is not something that employers would be required to do right away. In terms of the collection of premiums, we're looking out to January 1st, 2023. And as Ms. Fitzpatrick stated within her opening statements, we would hope to be post the COVID pandemic at that time. And I would also just say that, you know, what this pandemic has shown us is that there are moments in time where all of us may need a safety net. There have been a number of safety nets that have been available here through the state legislature for businesses and also federally through the payroll protection program as well. And so just as businesses need that level of support, the families who power those businesses sometimes need a safety net as well in order to have some support.
Representative Tyson, any follow-up?
Yes, please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Representative Richardson, I'm not very confident. I'm not very confident at all with the folks that I've been hearing from. They are not really sure they're going to make it. And so when we say that we would hope by 2023 that we're out of this COVID thing, I'm going to tell you, I don't know if we're going to have many businesses to take care of this. We have got so many people right now receiving unemployment benefits, and they won't come back. They won't come back to work. The governor has no plan to put us back to work, none whatsoever. I still say our best plan for our businesses and getting our economy going is for our governor to end his powers and get us back to work. I really don't know that we're going to make it. Yesterday, I went to get an adjustment by my chiropractor, and someone we know, a doctor, a young doctor who comes from a family of four doctors, she's got three little kids, and she committed suicide the other day. This is what we're going to be seeing, folks. I have no doubt that we're going to be seeing this more and more and more. People cannot deal with this. We need to get them back to work. We need to figure this out. Do I think this is a good idea? I do, but I don't like this plan. There's a lot of businesses that already have plans in place because they do believe it is a good idea to do it, but not this way. I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to vote yes for it. And as a woman, I wish I could, but I really don't feel this is in my best interest or my daughter-in-law's best interest at all. I'm just not really sure anybody's going to be in business once we finally get done with this, whenever that is. Thank you.
Representative Haley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It took a minute there. Thank you, Representative Richardson, for bringing this bill forward. I have a few questions for you. First of all, this is a new payroll tax, which you have said, both on employers and employees. Don't you feel that that is a disincentive for employers to be hiring workers?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Haley, for the question. So a point of clarification, employers can choose to share the costs, but would not have to do that. That would be within the employer's discretion, whether they would want to share those costs with employees. And in terms of the, I think the opportunities and the benefits that this bill brings around addressing employee retention, I think that is really critical because it's a point that we've heard made a couple of times here today within this hearing. And what we know research-wise is when we're thinking specifically about people returning to the workforce after having a new child, they are much more likely to return. Employers are much more likely to be able to retain individuals if there is access to leave. And I think the other piece that we are facing right now is really around the structural inequality that I talked a little bit about as well. The majority of Minnesotans don't have access to paid family and medical leave. And so often the individuals who are left out of having access to paid family medical leave are the lowest paid workers in Minnesota. Women, Black, Indigenous, and other workers of color are left out as well. And when we think about the challenges that we see around income inequality and the sort of historic pieces of this, you know, safety net programs like this are so critical to try to get to some level of universality for all Minnesotans, because even going back to the Social Security program that was entered into initially, 60% of Black folks in the United States were not able to get Social Security, because carved out of that were farmers and domestic workers. And so there's a legacy in this country of like not providing support oftentimes for those who need it most. And so that inequality piece is also a key piece of this as well.
Representative Haley?
Well, that was a long answer, Representative Richardson, thank you. But I think it was a simpler question, I guess, what I was looking for. Our businesses are competing for workers, not just in Minnesota, but all over the country, especially with the rapid adoption due to COVID to, you know, work from home and telework and the technology options that are available to workers. We are competing with every other state for workers. And the workforce shortage is an area that I focus on in the legislature, and we have a lot of data. So I'm very concerned about this becoming a disincentive to filling that gap that we have today. And what I hear from my businesses, I represent a region that does not have large businesses, a couple of them, and most of them are mid to small sized businesses, but even the struggling to implement the wage theft legislation that we passed last biennium and the cost of that administratively. And so adding another expansive program like you are proposing on top of that at a time when they are struggling already due to the impacts of the COVID economy and the shutdowns, I don't think helps our business competitiveness.
I think we may be lost Representative Haley.
And now we're looking to add more to that. So that again is a concern with our competitiveness. The small businesses that I represent in our district, similar to what Representative Tice said,
Representative Haley, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but your connection is not great. I don't know if you can hear me right now.
What I find with those smaller businesses.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but your connection keeps popping in and out. We're missing significant seconds.
We're having trouble today. Okay.
Yeah, and I just don't, I'm sorry to interrupt. I just don't want you to, we're not catching a lot of what you're saying. So can I suggest that maybe you try turning off your camera for a little while and see if maybe that helps?
I will do that.
Okay.
Okay, thank you, Chair Stevenson. I did not realize that it wasn't showing up on my end. So I guess the theme of my concern with this bill, again, is our business competitiveness, our challenge with the workforce shortages that we currently are facing in our state. And for our smaller employers, they cannot afford additional taxes. And what I find in, and this is much of Minnesota, our economy is supported by small employers. And their employees are like family. They provide flexibility when people need it, when families are struggling and people do everything they can to keep those employees on the payroll and able to come back to work. And a mandate on how they do that, I guess, is really what I'm opposed to. I haven't seen us talk about what taxes we will eliminate in order to add another tax on businesses, or what mandates we are willing to look at and reduce before we add yet another mandate. My other major concern is the testimony that the representative from the School Boards Association brought forth. Again, our schools are facing significant revenue shortages due to COVID and due to loss of students during school closures. I do not think this is a time to institute additional mandates on them that they will not have the money to pay for, and that will also impact their ability to keep and retain staff. I guess I know there's other people that want to ask questions, but those are my two chief concerns with the proposal at this time. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Representative Haley. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Richardson for bringing forward this bill. I couldn't agree with you more that attracting employees, retaining employees is going to be a critical activity that we as an economy and as a society and a culture need to look at. With the impending retirement of baby boomers that are hitting the retirement age, where COVID has sped up some of that retirement for those individuals, it's going to be very competitive in the marketplace. And my experience says that when demand is high and supply is low, things start to shift toward the supply being on the low side, being trying to attract, attracted into the employment environment. And that benefits and things tend to start moving toward hiring, retaining, and keeping employees. One of the things there's several things that I have concerns about, and I'm hoping that you can help me with these. I asked this question last year, and with this bill coming back from the interim, I'm hoping that we have an answer or a path for this. Will there be an actuarial review on this new social insurance program? Has Commerce been involved? Are they here today, maybe, to speak to that matter, Mr. Chair, or Representative Richardson?
I don't know that we have anyone. Representative Richardson, I don't know if you've answered the bill. I do see Mr. Brickwoody is here, but I'm not sure if he's here on this bill or for a later bill. Representative Richardson?
Thank you, Chair Stevenson, and thank you, Chair O'Driscoll, Representative O'Driscoll, for the question. We haven't had any conversations at this point about an actuarial review coming through the Commerce Department.
Representative O'Driscoll.
First, I want to say, Representative Richardson, thank you for the temporary promotion. I appreciate that. secondly, I want to thank Mr. Anderson as a private individual and as a private business for looking at the products that are out there that are actuarially reviewed and are actuarially sound and being able to be sold here in the state of Minnesota that our very own Commerce Department will run through the process and being able to do this. Taking that product that our Commerce Department would review and products similar to that and borrowing from the idea of the Affordable Care Act, or the Obamacare, would it make sense, Representative Richardson, or have you looked at offering tax credits to businesses to try to purchase private insurers who not only have the ability to reach across the state of Minnesota, but across the nation as insurance companies that would be admitted carriers not only in the state of Minnesota, but other states, to be able to get that bigger, solid base that many of your testifiers have been speaking about today. Representative Richardson?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, for the question. I think that what we have before us with this bill is the opportunity to take advantage of a lot of lessons that have been learned from a number of other states who have implemented plans over the last several years. And I think it speaks very highly of the Washington plan, their model, their sort of structure in terms of when they began to collect premiums versus when they began to pay out benefits, and the fact that their program was able to go live in the middle of a global pandemic, stay solvent, and also, be able to keep the premiums flat over the next year shows that there was a lot of thought that went into the sustainability of a program. And there was also built in into that the ability to accommodate many more claims than they anticipated within their first year of operation. And so I think that there can be a number of lessons learned from those other states in terms of building a sustainable plan.
Mr. Chair, I'm kind of batting cleanup for our side of the aisle here. In our view, I see we have some other members here. So if you'll indulge me with a few more questions as I want to just kind of walk through, make sure that we get a well-rounded conversation on this. Representative Richardson, in other committee hearings that we've had before this committee and before other committees, we hear about the continuity and the importance of continuity of care, the continuity of making sure that doctors, nurses, therapists, others who are providing services in the medical realm for the success of patients and for schools, special needs children, and trying to have that predictability for them. How does the bill anticipate taking care of the needs of those individuals for that continuity of care and continuity of education, et cetera, when the employer is going to be required to allow the leave, which I understand, there's a temporary worker that needs to come in that needs to be able to be trained, taught that position. And then in a matter of maybe 6 or 12 or 14 weeks, whatever the time frame is, a temporary worker is going to be moved out, and then we're going to have to bring the regular worker back in and ramp them up. How does that speak to the continuity of care and continuity of services for individuals that I hear so much about in committees that's important to us in our discussions here?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. Representative O'Driscoll, thank you for the question as well. So we know that right now people need leave. People have new children that they need to care for, they're caring for family members, or they're ill themselves. So this is in fact something that businesses are having to face right now. And in terms of what this plan really does is ensure that family members that are in the position to have to take leave, that they have a safety net. And in terms of what that looks like from the employee perspective, because you would have individuals paying into a pool and being covered by that pool, it would actually free up dollars within the employers to be able to bring individuals on for coverage. And what that coverage looks like, I think, is really going to vary based upon industry. For schools, for example, there are pools of individuals who have the ability to come in and to be substitute teachers. From a medical perspective, maybe it's relying on locum tenens to be able to have individuals come in to provide that coverage. And so I think it's really a case-by-case basis in terms of looking at the industry, what's going to be available. If you need an accountant, there are pools for that. There are definitely challenges in terms of certain professions of where there's severe shortages. We know that, like within the nursing field, that there are severe shortages around that, but there are going to be severe shortages just as a matter of course.
And Mr. Chair, I have one comment and then one follow-up question. The question was raised earlier, and I do have some information with my research here, and I want to just bring that up if I could. The question was how much time. I think Representative Rasmussen raised the question about were there any other states that had 24 weeks of leave. My data that I've been able to come across says that in the state of Washington, there were some questions about that. It's up to 12 weeks of medical and family leave combined for 18 weeks during the year. So 12 weeks on an individual, 16 weeks combined. And if maternity or paternity leave was a part of that, it would be a combination of medical and family leave up to 18 weeks if it involved pregnancy as one of the qualifiers on that. So we're talking about offering anywhere between probably about another 4 weeks more than what the state of Washington is doing. The other item that I want to address is there an offset, Representative Richardson, for employers who are going to be receiving, and we all know this is coming. I hope that Ms. Peterson and others who are small business owners are budgeting for this next year in their budgeting plans for 2022. Our unemployment insurance fund is woefully underfunded right now. There's a huge deficit in there. And in state statute right now, it says that the employer contribution will go from 0.1% to 0.5% plus a 14% surcharge. The folks are going to be seeing a rather hefty tax on their payroll in Minnesota because of the unemployment tax. If we were to now add the family medical leave tax on top of that increased unemployment tax, is there any kind of a tax credit or offset if you're paying the unemployment
on fees that you would be receiving a reduction or a waiver in this new plan that's not up and running to be able to sustain and support a program that we currently do have under our unemployment insurance.
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll, for the question. And I think in terms of the of looking at different leave programs and the way that they can also intersect with disability leave as well, there are some programs that actually provide more than 24 weeks of leave. And so, I mean, that's really on a state-by-state basis looking at that. In terms of thinking through the solvency of this program, again, I think that there are lessons learned from other states in terms of the timing of when you start the program, in terms of thinking about the collection of premiums, and also the timing in which you begin to pay out benefits, as well as other states have been able to start, develop, and implement self-funding programs. They've used that model of the delay of paying out premiums in order to build up a system that is going to be solvent.
Representative Driscoll, I think you've got a lot of clear questions, so if you have any closing comments.
Chair, thank you. Representative Richardson, thank you. Mr. Chair, thank you for the time. I appreciate the discussion today.
Thank you. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think maybe just a couple of observations. First, to thank you to Chair Richardson for bringing this bill forward and drawing out, I think, that amongst the lessons we can take away from the pandemic, if we choose to take lessons away from the pandemic, is how this has stressed families and how it has exposed access to resources, including things like access to family leave when we need it. I'm struck by the observation that the small business people who testified today all testified in favor of the bill, and the people who claim to represent business interests all testified against it. And I guess I would urge those organizations to check back with their membership, because when we're told by members, the small businesses in my area can't do this or can't do that, the small businesses that we're actually hearing from are telling us they want this. And I would urge the committee to kind of try to change the mindset from this is going to be a burden on employers to the opportunity this provides employers and employees to better manage real life. And that making Minnesota a more, when we talk about where does Minnesota stand competitively with other states and how do we recruit new employees into the state, whether it's for our small businesses across the state line or our big businesses who bring people in and out to headquarters, being a more competitive place to work has long been a Minnesota advantage. We've used our strengths to, I often hear from larger businesses, it's hard to get people to move here because they read about the winter. And then once they're here, it's hard to get them to leave because for many, the quality of life is there, but not all. I think we can move forward on this and recognize that the state moving forward on this is a more efficient and less expensive way of providing these services to all, that doing things like relying on the private sector or relying on tax credits to incent the private sector really only subsidizes the unproductive elements of the insurance industry. You know, we know in healthcare that public programs have much lower administrative costs than private programs. And this is an opportunity for us to meet the needs of Minnesota families in an efficient way that makes Minnesota a better place to live and a more competitive place to be an employer and employee. So thank you, Representative Richardson. Mr. Chair, you'll be glad I'm done with my soliloquy.
I always enjoy your soliloquies, Representative Dabney. I will note for members that we have 15 minutes left in this committee. We do have two bills left on the calendar. I think we'll probably only get through one of those, but I would really like to get through at least one more bill after this one. So Representative Lislegarde.
Mr. Chair, with that, and due to the process, I will speak with Representative Richardson offline. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lisler. Representative Katisa Batoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Richardson, thank you for carrying this bill after former Chair Halverson left the legislature. I know that this is a passion of hers. It's a passion of mine. I'm a proud co-author, and I am grateful to you for following up on this really important program for all Minnesotans. I have a couple thoughts that I wanted to share today, Mr. Chair, so I appreciate the opportunity to speak. First off, I did ask that RCA send out a study that was commissioned by the Washington Chamber of Commerce prior to the implementation of their paid family leave program. Has a number of statistics that I think are really important for us to review, just kind of in comparison. And one of them being that in 2019, Washington employers incurred costs of $2.08 billion related to employee turnover or missed work due to childcare issues. So this is something that is impacting families all across the nation, all across the world, and somehow we are still the only industrialized country that doesn't have access for our fellow Minnesotans, our fellow Americans. And so I think that that's something to really consider when we talk about the cost to employers, but also the cost to employees and to their families. I also wanted to quickly respond to Mr. Anderson's point about private market and what is available on the private market, because I was reviewing one of the handouts that was attached to our committee event here, and I think is accessible for the public online, but I think it was on page 4 of the Main Street Alliance Minnesota Paid Family Leave storybook. And so it's a chart that's kind of describes here a couple different insurance options and then what it would look like under the PFML Act. So it looks at the monthly premium and cost. So there's two Colonial Life agents that were listed, one at roughly $50, one at roughly $35. Aflac was listed at rounding up to $23, and then the PFML is roughly $16 that we round up continually. So 60% wage replacement rate, the PFML Act would have approximately 66% average. The leave available, 6 weeks, 6 weeks, 6 weeks, and then PFML Act would allow 12 weeks. There's a minimum hospital stay for both the Colonial Life agents. There's none for Aflac, none for the PFML Act. Exclusions. Now, this is where it gets a little bit personal for me. The Colonial Life policies apparently exclude paternity leave, foster care, adoption, aging parent care, and cancer. Aflac just excludes cancer, and the PFML Act excludes none of those issues. So I used to work for a small consulting company here in Minnesota, and back in 2018, my husband and I welcomed three children through the Minnesota foster care system. I took FMLA because PFML wasn't accessible to me. Not that the company didn't provide some sort of paid family leave, but it was categorized. So if you had a vaginal birth, you got up to 12 weeks, I believe, and some of that was through disability insurance. If you adopted an infant, you got 6 weeks. If you adopted a child older than the age of infancy, you got nothing. And so that was something that when Representative Richardson talks about the universality of this program, it's something that's really important, because in that situation, I was pitted against my coworkers who were receiving benefits that the company was willing to provide, but apparently only if I could get pregnant. And now this past year, I had the blessing of doing so, but my husband and I, up to that point, didn't think that we were going to be able to have a biological child. So that doesn't make any sense to me. It doesn't make any sense that these insurance companies would exclude foster care and adoption. It doesn't make any sense to me that these companies would choose to exclude paternity care when we see the research specifically in the early childhood area that when parents, both parents, are accessible and able to bond with their children during those first few weeks and months of life, it's a benefit and it's a boon to families' growth and everything that they would come into contact with as that child continues to mature. So that's that's something I wanted to share personally. And I also just wanted to touch upon the testifier who had mentioned that this PFML program is not consistent with FMLA. There's a couple major differences. One, that it's not paid. And so, yes, some people are able to take the time away from work that they need when they need it, but it also makes the finances of doing so really, really difficult and tricky for families. It also leaves out approximately half of workers because it doesn't cover small businesses under 50 employees, and you have to work there for at least a full year. So I can tell you that I was entertaining the option of leaving my job at that point in time when I knew that I wasn't going to be able to access any of the paid leave options when we welcomed our children. But then I was concerned that I wouldn't be able to access FMLA leave if I wasn't at a job prior to our children being placed with us. So there's a lot of considerations each individually. And I know that this is my story, but I think that a big part of why my constituents sent me here is because of that story. So I want to make sure that people hear it. And Representative Richardson, if I can do any more to support this bill, I'm so grateful for that opportunity. And I think that the time is now. We have to pass this bill.
Agreed. The time is now, and it's time to pass the bill. Representative Richardson, any brief closing comments?
I would just ask for support. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, and I assume you are renewing your motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And with that, Representative Richardson renews her motion that House File 1200 be re-referred to the Human Services Policy and Finance Committee. Mr. Brown will take the roll. The chair votes aye.
Vice Chair Katisa Watoon.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll.
I'm hoping that was as amended. No.
Representative Barr.
No.
Representative Carlson.
Yes.
Representative Davney.
Aye.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Haley.
No.
Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard, aye.
Representative Lucero.
No.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
No.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, no.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Representative Tice. Representative Tice.
No.
With 11 ayes and 7 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 1200, as amended, is recommended to be referred to the Committee on Human Services, Finance, and Policy. Thank you, Representative Richardson. Members, we have 8 minutes left. I think I had been inclined. We're going to try and take testimony on House File 1589, Representative Ruth Richardson's other bill, which is going to be laid over. There is members of the public here today who are here for this bill. So we're going to take the testimony on that bill. It is being laid over, so we will have a chance to have a complete discussion and amendments if... Well, no one filed amendments in advance anyway, but we'll have a chance to have a complete discussion on the bill at a later time. So Representative Richardson, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Richardson moves House File 1589 be laid over for further consideration. Representative Richardson, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1589 is a bill designed to address the spike in catalytic converter thefts in Minnesota. A common theme that we're hearing from departments across the state is it's not unusual for officers to pull someone over and for them to have 4 or 5 catalytic converters in their vehicle. While these thefts occur frequently, it's difficult to track, and this bill is trying to address that by not only being able to regulate the sale of catalytic converters to scrap metal dealers, but also by creating a requirement that individuals would have to have ownership verification and documents for catalytic converters. I do have 2 testifiers here with me today, including Jeff Ditburner.
All right, Mr. Ditburner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Dipperner. I live in Invergrove Heights, and I'm a victim of catalytic converter theft. I'm here today to speak in support of House File 1589. I went into 2020 full of optimism. I just finished my bachelor's degree. I'd been accepted to a master's program, and I had several jobs lined up. Then in January, I started my car, and I heard the menacing roar of a missing catalytic converter. That sound that's familiar to too many Minnesotans. Right after that, COVID hit and my family was down to one income and the jobs were scarce. The $1,000 bill to replace the catalytic converter could not have come at a worse time. For a while after the theft, I winced as I started my car, wondering if I was going to hear that sound again. And fortunately, that feeling went away after a while. That was until last month when my car was hit a second time. Mr. Chair and members, despite our differences, Minnesotans want to feel safe in our community and able to take care of our families. Long before the pandemic struck, too many of us, especially Black, Brown, Indigenous, and people of color, were struggling to get by. With so many people on the financial brink, $1,000 can easily make or break a household budget. So, we voted for a divided legislature, but Minnesotans are united in our hope that you all can work together to pass a common sense bill like House File 1589 that will help prevent the anxiety and financial burden that this crime has imposed on countless Minnesotans. I want to thank Representative Richardson for authoring this bill and inviting me to speak, and I urge you all to support it. Thank you very much.
All right, we do have one other testifier, and that testifier is from the author, and that is Kurt Hallstrom, the senior commander of the Eastern District of the City of St. Paul Police Department. Mr. Hallstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am in the St. Paul Police Department is in support of this bill. Just to give a couple stories similar to the story that was just given, I just read a police report the other day where an individual who had some other issues going on in their lives, but they were also in possession of a receipt from a relatively new sale of two catalytic converters at a metal recycling place outside the city of St. Paul. But it's not uncommon that the officers are out on the streets and they'll come across people that, like the Representative Richardson said, have multiple catalytic converters either in the back seat or in the trunks of the cars. There is no identifiable marks on the catalytic converter to make it remotely plausible that we will be able to find and put that catalytic converter back to the vehicle in which it came from, thus making it a very difficult crime to track. I think in the city of St. Paul, we had nearly 800 catalytic converters stolen in 2020. And some of the people, as the previous testifier stated, were hit multiple times with really high bills. So, it's a bill that we were behind with the police department because it gives us actionable ability to take action on the site, confiscate the catalytic converter, and issue a citation or arrest of the person in possession of it. It also allows the scrapping of junk vehicles and other things to continue and not necessarily put the burden on the metal recyclers. And we also like the idea that the person that's scrapping the catalytic converter is going to have to give their name and a check will be mailed to them. And thus we can go look for individuals that might be scrapping multiple catalytic converters in a week versus the big scrappers that are doing it as a professional business. Appreciate your time, Mr. Chair and the committee. I have nothing further.
Thank you, Mr. Alstrom. We do have two members of the public here to testify. I will give them each an opportunity to testify for about a minute. We are laying the bill over, so they can have the opportunity to come back when we hear the bill again. Jeremy Estenson, you are first. Mr. Estenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Richardson. My name is Jeremy Estenson. I work for the Stinson Law Firm here representing the Institute of Scrap Recycling Industries, or ISRI. We are the folks that Mr. Hallstrom referred to as the recyclers of all kinds of different metal things. Catalytic converters are one of the things that occasionally come through the doors. Given the time constraints, the two things that I want to convey are, in 2007 and 2008, the legislature passed a series of new regulations found in Chapter 325E.21, the language that this bill seeks to amend. And that requires that everyone who comes through the doors and sells anything at a scrap recycler's facility has video taken of their face, their license plate, picture of the scrap item, whatever it is that's being sold, affidavit is signed saying that they own it and have the right to sell it, they're paid by a check, so on and so forth. What we see is very few individuals coming in to sell catalytic converters. We see a Midas tire shop or a muffler shop, excuse me, or a local facility that may purchase these things and do maintenance on vehicles and then come and sell them to us. So we share Representative Richardson's objective in solving the problem along with Mr. Hallstrom and Mr. Dipburner. We look forward to working with Representative Richardson. We've been working with Representative Davids and Senator Housley. Senator Housley was, of course, herself a victim of this crime, to come up with something that we think is workable and moves the ball in the right direction. And Mr. Chair, you've got our word to continue working with all the stakeholders.
Well, thank you, Mr. Estensen. I was mistaken. There isn't a second testifier, which is good because it is 4:30. My apologies to Representative Dabney and Mr. Smith that we didn't get to that bill. I'm letting members of the committee know that it will be on the agenda tomorrow, so we will take it up, House File 1067 then. Thank you to everyone, and the meeting is adjourned.